Good morning. I want to thank you, first of all, because this is the prettiest space I have gotten to speak in 2.5 years. So, as someone who appreciates the aesthetics as well as the content, I am very grateful to be able to be in such a beautiful place. Oh, we've got a lot to do in very little time. I'm going to ask you this morning to do a few things, and some of them we will have some opportunity to warm up to, and some of them I'm going to launch into as well. But first and foremost, I want to ask you to just look around the room at the people that are here. I don't know about you, but I am encouraged to be here engaging in an honest discourse with people who come from different ages, different backgrounds, different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, different racial experiences, different gender identities and expressions. I am encouraged by that. I am also always disappointed to note that there are empty seats in the space. Empty seats which both represent those people who are not ready to engage in this dialogue with us. Empty seats which we must acknowledge are the lost lives that AIDS and HIV have taken from us, and empty seats who are the people who are lost in their own fear, bigotry, and prejudice, and cannot bring themselves to ask internal or external questions which would be necessary to be here today. But I am encouraged that you are here, and I'm encouraged that we are going to have a day that is about telling the truth, the hard truth, the easy truth, and the truth is brought into a conversation that is otherwise incredibly difficult. The combined weight of our struggles to survive and overwhelming losses, the combined weight of all of that, the fact that we still do not have a cure. Is everyone aware of this? Because I go places sometimes where people don't know this, and you're smart folks, but I want to make sure you're clear on this. The improvements in medications are not a cure for AIDS. We still don't have one. See, I'm thrilled that we're here today where we can tell the truth about that, because I actually believe we're capable of miracles together. Actual, real miracles. My theology includes a belief that the miracle stories are happening today as much as they were happening then. It doesn't matter to me if the Bible is a historical document. It matters to me that in our hearts we hold the place for miracles. So today is a day of miracles, and today is a day of healing. On a personal note, in 1988, AIDS entered into my life. Now, like many of you, I'm sure I had heard a news article or I had seen someone use the word somewhere, but in 1988, my uncle Patrick, a man who had been absent from my life for most of my childhood, returned to Abilene, Texas, where I grew up, to his Church of Christ, and not United Church of Christ, but Church of Christ family. There is a difference, in case you didn't know. His Church of Christ conservative evangelical Christian family, because he had nowhere else to go. He had lost his job, he was losing what benefits he had left, and he needed a place to die. See, my uncle was gay, and not only had he not been a part of our lives because he was gay, but he had not been a part of our lives because our personal and familial theology didn't make room to even talk about him. His life wasn't just dismissed by us, it was invisible to us. And yet we were the best he had when that critical time in his life came and he needed somewhere to go. I was 13 years old. What an impressionable and incredible time in life. And I knew, watching the death and dying process of my gay uncle, who we never acknowledged openly the sexuality of, and who we lied about his death and said he died of liver cancer. I watched his process and determined then that that felt for me like injustice. I also recognized then that I also was a gay man. I'd never really known what was different about me, but something clearly always had been. Over time, I began to understand that there was something about that intersection of difference and justice. And later I would understand difference, justice, and healing. that would be key to the centrality of my life for the rest of the years of it. In 2001, after a lot of life struggle in my own journey, I also received my own HIV-positive diagnosis. And it could have been a crushing moment in my life. But it wasn't a crushing moment in my life because I had not only the lessons I had learned from my uncle's experience, but I had been in rooms of people like you, having an honest dialogue. And it had made space both in my heart and my spirit and in my mind to understand that even after a diagnosis like that, things could, in fact, be different. That actually things today can be different than things that happened before because those miracles are still occurring. I also know that for those of you who are here with HIV in your bodies today, that there's a cost for you to be here. That you sit here in this room, whether you come out today or any day about your status, and you bear an emotional weight and burden that those without the disease do not always understand. And so I acknowledge you for taking the risk to be here. I honor you for taking the risk to be here. And each and every time you do choose to come out, I hope you know that there are both the spirits of all who went before us and many of us who are standing on the front lines of the activism of this who will stand with you in each moment of that coming out. And for those of you who are here as allies, I am also aware that it costs you something to be here. And this is a piece of the dialogue that we don't talk about enough. It costs something to allow the impact of AIDS to be felt in a meaningful way in our lives. But the cost of not having the conversation is exponentially greater than the cost of having it. Can we have agreement on that to start us off? All right. I'm not actually Pentecostal, but I'm learning. Hallelujah. The impact of AIDS fractures relationship with the body, the community, and faith, often requiring radical acts of healing and restoration. Surviving AIDS is as such a walk of the Spirit. It is an exploration of faith and a confrontation of our most palpable humanity. If you are ever confused about the palpable experience of living with and confronting life-defining illnesses, you need to go spend some time in a nursing home or hospice, helping someone clean their body, deal with failing body systems, and navigating an inability to take care of things that once we took for granted is our most palpable pieces of humanity. And it is also one of the moments when we really get it, that if we didn't have a spirit to get us through this, there wouldn't have been much point in having this thing we walked around in. We can't have a spiritual walk if we don't have a physical walk, and we can't have a physical walk if we do not include our spirit in the process. So today is both of those things, a walk of the body and a walk of the spirit. Surviving AIDS is just such a walk, and it is serious work. It is significant in its challenge, and it demands that we be more than we thought we could be. So if we're going to do something serious together, it might help if we all did a little homework. I didn't want to email it out because I didn't know who was coming, and I thought someone would miss the assignment, and then you'd be embarrassed, have to tell me your dog ate it. So instead, we'll just take care of it right now. First, I want to note that for the purpose of simplification, the acronym AIDS I will use today in place of HIV and AIDS. It saves time, and I don't have that much with you. It is relevant to note, though, that it's important sometimes to use the distinction between the two terms. So today, we're going to talk in broader brushstrokes about the impact of AIDS, which also includes the impact of HIV in our community, our world, and our bodies. So if you're sitting in the pews and you're thinking, but I thought there was a difference, there is. But today we're going to talk at the 10,000-foot level umbrella rather than at the 100-foot level, if that makes sense. I am, for those of you who don't know me, also a fan of audience participation. Don't worry, I won't make you stand up here, do a dance, or sing if you're not into that. These are relatively easy pieces of audience participation. First, we need to admit a very important and painful truth if we're going to engage this topic. Take a deep breath and listen carefully, please. AIDS is not over. Can you feel the impact of that? AIDS is not over. We were led to believe a little more than a decade ago that the end of AIDS had arrived when improved medical science and treatments became available in this country and in Europe and in Canada and later in Australia. But AIDS is not over. One trip to Africa will clarify this issue to you in a heartbeat. One trip to most of the impoverished neighborhoods in the United States will clarify this issue to you. Any visitation in a major urban city in the United States now to the local Department of Health will clarify this issue. And quite frankly, even in those communities which have access to the medications that have been improved, we know that AIDS is not over. So let's try this together. I want you to say it with me. This will be our call and response piece of the service today. AIDS is not over. Your turn. AIDS is not over. Let's do it again. AIDS is not over. It is unthinkable that globalization has made the Coca-Cola logo and the McDonald's name brand accessible and recognizable around the world. But there are people who do not know that AIDS even exists yet, who suddenly find themselves in a death and dying process and don't know what it is that they're sick with and don't have access to medical care to help them out. AIDS is, in fact, not over. It cannot be relegated to the history books as something that happened to a generation long gone. It cannot, in good conscience, be ignored. It cannot be avoided unless we are willing to continue to lose the lives of people around the world and allow countless others to be, to be permanently altered by a life-defining illness. AIDS is not over. If you leave here with nothing else to consider, I hope that you will take that home and have that conversation with the people around you, and in particular, with your peer groups, have that conversation. And then I challenge you to take it a step further and move out of your peer groups and talk to someone in a different generation than you about it. Maybe that's a young person in school today, or maybe that's your grandparents, or maybe that's a cousin or a friend or a coworker. But we got to get the message out. AIDS is not over. Next, in our preparation for today, I'm going to ask that we attempt to access our spiritual selves to walk this path together. I just find it's easier if we're going to be in chapel that we treat this as an act of prayer with one another. Can we agree today as a common and shared spiritual practice to breathe? To breathe deeply as an act of community and corporate prayer. Breath, that thing that we take so for granted, is not something that those of us with life-defining illnesses get to take for granted. So let's try it. Three deep, healing, centering breaths. Are you ready? One. Two. And three. When we enter into a discussion of illness and its impact, it makes sense to remember that we do not live in our heads alone. For those of us living with AIDS, cancer, asthma, diabetes, fibromyalgia, and many others, the ability to breathe is something we don't get to take for granted anymore. Breath that can be taken away is all the more precious. Breathing can calm the spirit and soothe pain. Breathing in and breathing out can center our spirits and nurture our bodies. So today I ask that we breathe deeply. And at the moments when you feel your emotions reaching that crest, when you think, I don't want to listen to any more of this or I don't want to take it in, I remind you that that is the moment when you need to breathe more than ever. Something is about to happen for you when you get a little uncomfortable. Finally, in preparation, I need to ask for our agreement to be honest. I can offer you so much more of what I carry inside me if you are willing to let me do that authentically and honestly. I will need to talk about some hard realities and painful history to guide our walk. And I can receive so much more of what you have if you don't wrap them up in pretty wrapping paper, falsehoods, or deceptions. You don't need to look good in this room today. Which means it's okay if you want to cry. It's okay if you want to be angry with me or with AIDS or with the church at the end of our time together. It is okay to be uncomfortable here. It is also okay to want to celebrate the fact that a seminary in this day and age is engaging in this conversation, that people put their money and their time and their scheduling behind making this happen. So it's okay to be happy today, too. If we can agree to these things, to be in a spiritual space, a space of breath, which is actually an act of prayer for us, a place of honesty, if we can agree to those things together, could I ask you for an amen?
Amen.
Hallelujah. AIDS challenges the very limits of human compassion and endurance. From its debut as a misunderstood killer of people on the margins of our society to its modern incarnation as a destructive catalyst of change for millions of lives around the world, AIDS has required that people infected and affected by the disease delve deep into our physical, emotional, and spiritual resources for survival. AIDS has often left us with more questions than answers. Just when it seems we will get ahead of the challenge, a new and harsh reality comes to light. So there's a tool, a gift that was given to me by a physician recently, and I'd like to give it to you. He is one of the top 100 doctors serving HIV populations around the world and does 50% of his time with patient care and 50% of his time with the drug companies, calling them to ethics and challenges. And if there is an expert in the field, he would be it. And we were sitting in a meeting, and I said, "What is the most important thing that you have learned in your work with AIDS and HIV? And he said the following: three words that if you want to do this work, you must know how to use honestly. And I said, got my pen out, I was ready. I'll give them to you as a gift today. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. If a doctor at the top of his game around this after 2.5 decades can say, I don't know, it tells us that there are more questions than answers that are being posed by this mysterious condition. AIDS has often caused us to dig deep for answers that simply are not yet available to us. So how do we find our place in this work? What do we need to do to engage AIDS on each of the many levels it impacts our bodies, lives, and communities? How do we resolve the ignorance, misunderstanding, and stigma which continue to damage the lives of people infected and affected by this disease? I can't give you a simple answer to that, but I can help you look analytically at some of the pieces that we need to consider and spiritually encourage you towards your own answers. We must first be willing to admit our humanity and shortcomings. There are three words. There we go. I don't know. Admitting that we still don't have a long-term solution to stopping the spread of the disease, nor do we have a cure, is a powerful way to access the idea of I don't know. Admitting to people now living dependent on combination therapies, also known as drug cocktails, that we cannot, in fact, predict what other conditions will arise from utilizing these very powerful and often toxic drugs over the course of many years is an act of integrity. It is an act of integrity to say, I don't know what will happen to your body after a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. When my physician told me that the best news he had for me was that he could now extend my life by 25 years, which was a promise my uncle did not receive. 25 years because that's how long the longest person has survived on the medications. And not even the good medications I have. That was the bad medications that went before. But he said, I can guarantee you that we will do everything in our power to give you 25 more years. And I felt grateful for that at the time. And then he said, and the bad news of what I have to tell you is that I don't know what will happen to you over the course of 2.5 decades taking these medications. And we'll have to wait and see. I don't know becomes a very powerful thing to say when it is offered with authenticity and paired with compassion. Follow that up with the words, I care. I don't know, but I care. I don't know, and I care. I don't know, I care about you. And if you add to that, I am willing to be here with you, I am willing to hear your concerns, I am willing to know your struggle. I don't know, but I care, and I'm willing. We could all go home now and have a pretty good start on doing what we need to do together. One of the hardest realities of the early days with AIDS was that we weren't in a place where we knew how to say, I don't know, in integrity. It has been a gift of this disease and our walk with this disease that we have had to learn those things and how to learn to do them in an honest and open place. The incredible isolation and stigma that was coming into the lives of people who found themselves sick in the beginning had a lot to do with arrogance. It had a lot to do with fear and arrogance paired together. And it had a lot to do with the fact that we were still willing to subdivide communities up and say, you over there in the third row, you will now be identified for the rest of your life as the locus of contagion, and the rest of us will now have to be careful in how we deal with you. That was a fictional moment, wasn't it? But the reality is it doesn't feel very good, does it? But for those of us that were in those communities, and for those of us who continue to be in those communities, every time the label gets attached to the disease, we find ourselves returning to those early moments. Now, on top of whatever other life challenges we were attempting to overcome, we're dealing with being sick, too. And the implied message, the not-so-hidden subtext that emerged, was that as human beings, we were somehow to be blamed for this illness and for its spread in the world. A condition that, in fact, no one could identify an origin for, nor clarify how to prevent its transmission. How confusing it must have been in those first few days. And how sad that 2.5 decades later, we are still relatively confused about how to have that conversation. So I want to take a look back at the beginning, because I think that if we don't talk about our history, we are, in fact, doomed to repeat it. Many of us in this room have had a very real experience of that again and again and again around the things that face us in churches or our communities of origin. On July 3rd, 1981, how many of you were above the age of 10 on July 3rd, 1981? Okay. I wasn't. I shouldn't have written. No, I'm just kidding. The New York Times published an article that would change the lives of one of the groups I'm referring to, pretty much across the United States, but actually worldwide, for the next 2.5 decades that followed. They published an article which was titled, Rare Cancer Seen in 41 Homosexuals. It provided a broad and mixed and vague medical description of a condition which was appearing out of nowhere and seemed to be targeting, and they used the word again and again, which is why I'm going to use it again and again, which appeared to be targeting homosexual men. Now, in 1972, homosexual was just being determined to no longer be a psychiatric condition. So I don't know about any of you in the room, but if my cultural and historical memory was close enough to that term being derogatory, this article in the New York Times, one of the most legitimated papers in our country, probably would have been hard to see. The article held very little useful information about how a person became sick with this mysterious cancer, which they were still calling it, or even how to find out if you had it. But it did leave you with a very clear impression that homosexuals were getting sick with a rare condition. For homophobic and heterosexist readers, the labels being attached to the disease indicated that something unhealthy and immoral was creating the circumstance in the homosexuals. And even before we really knew that sexual transmission was one of the main pathways for the spread of the disease, the very identification of homosexuals as the sick and dying brought up our feelings of sex negativity that existed in the community and culture. author and activist Gail Rubin, writing near this time in her landmark article, Thinking Sex, Notes for a Radical Theory of the Politics of Sexuality, keenly addresses these feelings that were emerging in the time. She states, most of the discourses on sex and those ailments which are related to sexual activities, be they religious, psychiatric, popular, or political, delimit a very small portion of human sexual capacity as sanctifiable, safe, healthy, mature, legal, or politically correct. The word sanctifiable really got to me when I read that. See, here she is. She's someone confronting and critiquing what's going on around this issue. But when she put the word sanctifiable down in that article, she got to me as a person of faith. Conversations about what is moral and immoral get confusing to me sometimes. And the more I engage in conversations with people of multiple faith traditions, I realize that that word really gets lost in a bunch of misunderstanding. But sanctifiable, whew, that one gets me right back in my Church of Christ roots. In this model, she notes that there is a sexual hierarchy created by human beings, that's us, that draws a line between good sex and bad sex, and notably between what happens when good sex happens and you don't get sick, and bad sex happens and you do. Rubin continues by saying, the line distinguishes the good sex and those having it from all other erotic behaviors, which are understood to be the work of the devil, dangerous, psychopathological, infantile, or politically reprehensible. There was a time not long before this in our country where interracial marriage was being treated in a very similar way. And yet we don't learn the lessons of history if we do not continue to talk about them. The reality is that people have sex. And in our churches, we've got to find a way to admit that people have sex. Our best efforts has not spoiled that for the human condition. In this model that she's talking about, Rubin challenges us to ask, how are we contributing, no matter what our identification is, to the drawing of the line between what is good and moral, what is sanctifiable, and what falls in that other category? So the very morning that edition of the New York Times hit newsstands, the lines began to be drawn between the experiences of people with this disease and those people with other diseases, which were not their fault. Not their fault. It's your fault if you got it by having something on the bad side of the line. It is not your fault if you're one of the other people. Now, a few years later, we would get very confused when suddenly there were people with this disease that were, and you might remember this, innocent victims. Yeah. You know what innocent victims as a term did to those of us who were on the bad side of the line? It guaranteed that we didn't go to our doctors. It guaranteed that we didn't seek the help and support and education that we needed. Because who could take on the responsibility suddenly of not only knowing that you had been stigmatized, but then being told that you were killing children? It was an ugly and dark moment in those days. The New York Times, attempting to be balanced and to address the ongoing nature of what was happening, published another article about a year later, August the 8th, 1982. This time they would offer more information, but they would also concretize the perceptions that they had only been suggesting before. Now, I went back and forth over the last week about how much of this article to share with you, and I'm gonna read the majority of it, and there's a reason. There isn't a piece of literature that came out that year that actually states what was happening more clearly than this. So I want you to listen, but I want you to listen to this in a deeper way. I want you to imagine that having heard this for the first time, that you were the person or people who were being talked about. I want you to listen to it and imagine that you didn't yet have the disease that was being described, but that this cultural and physiological phenomenon was on its way in your life. I want you to imagine that you had one of the physical symptoms that are being described and didn't even know if you had a doctor who had access to the medical care to help you figure that out. The title of the article read as follows: A Disease's Spread Provokes Anxiety. It starts like this. The persistence of a serious disease whose victims are primarily homosexual men has touched off anxiety among homosexuals in New York City, where nearly half of the nation's cases have been reported. Side note, the word homosexual is used twice in the first sentence of the article. Doctors treating homosexuals say they are flooded with telephone calls from old and new patients with minor complaints. Clinics offering testing for the disease are oversubscribed. And homosexual men speak of great confusion over how to adjust their health habits to avoid the disease, which remains largely mysterious in its symptoms and causes. The disease, called acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS, produces a suppression of the body's natural defenses and sets the stage for the intrusion of several deadly afflictions, including a rare cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma and a rare pneumonia. They like the word homosexual and the word rare a lot. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta have recorded 505 cases of the syndrome coupled with the cancer pneumonia or other opportunistic infections since the national facility began gathering data on cases in June of last year. Of those people, of those 505 cases, 202 have died, or 40%. The cases include 243 residents of New York City. Reports of the disease have not abated. About 2 new cases a day are recorded at the Disease Control Center. Officials there attribute the increase both to improved reporting and to a real rise in cases. The disease has already killed more people than reported cases of toxic shock syndrome and the original outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, and it has engendered as much fear. Dr. David J. Sensor, New York's health commissioner, has termed the immune deficiency syndrome a major health problem. He emphasized that groups other than homosexual men were involved. Now, those of you who have been around long enough know that there were 4 groups originally identified. We often refer to them as the 4 H's. So here they put them out. All right, we have now again and again identified homosexual men in the category. We're going to add in. Groups afflicted with the syndrome include more than 60 heterosexual men and women who were IV drug users and used intravenous needles. 30 male and female immigrants from, and all heterosexual, and some hemophiliacs. Heroin users, homosexuals, Haitians, and hemophiliacs. Those 4 H's got tossed around and used as a weapon again and again and again during that period of time with no analysis being done publicly about what it meant to those communities. With no analysis about the classism, about the race, about the disease phobia, the heterosexism, or the homophobia that were implicit in saying the 4 H's again and again and again as parts of, say, presidential platforms at the time. But then again, you would have had to have a president who was willing to talk about HIV and AIDS in those days. And that was Reagan, and he wasn't. Doctors theorize, returning to the article, doctors theorize that the disease is an infectious agent transmitted in a complex way through sexual contact or through blood, yet in many cases, one person in a long-time sexual relationship will get the syndrome while the partner will not. That was probably some of the most useful information that was provided in the entire article. And then they do something which was the New York Times attempt to be good and liberal and balanced in the article. They acknowledge that one of the groups working to combat the situation was, in fact, members of the gay and lesbian community. At the time, really, mostly we said gay community. Later, we would move into LGBTIQQ and allies, which is where we are now. But that's a big progression. Back in those days, the National Gay Task Force is noted as coordinating a conference on the disease and publications for homosexuals, including The Advocate, Christopher Street, and New York Native, have been printing extensive articles about it. It's basically frightening because no one knows what's causing it, says a young man in Greenwich Village. The article goes on to talk about the anxiety in the community. It goes on to talk about doctors who don't know what to tell people, except that limiting sexual activity is probably a good idea. It goes on to note that members of the homosexual community appear to be trying to respond to something that still doesn't have an answer about it. When I read that article and the other articles that were coming out at that time, it hits me on a deep emotional level. I can hear all the confusion, pain, and anxiety of the people who suddenly found themselves at the epicenter of a major crisis. From those pinpoint moments of anxiety and pain, a massive public health and community response began to grow. For those of you who are interested in truly engaging that portion of the journey, I recommend And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz. The movie version is very good, but it actually misses some very important parts of what was going on. And the book is incredibly comprehensive and worth reading. While medical experts and community groups like the Gay Men's Health Crisis were scrambling to get accurate data, support the sick and dying, and stop the spread of the disease, other community leaders took this painful moment as an opportunity to lash out on a moral grounds. These were people supposedly of faith. Susan Sontag, in her brilliant book, AIDS and Its Metaphors, offers the following critique of these folks. Professional fulminators can't resist the rhetorical opportunity offered by a sexually transmitted disease that is lethal. Thus, the fact that AIDS is predominantly a heterosexually transmitted illness in the countries where it first emerged in epidemic form has not prevented such guardians of public morals as Jesse Helms and Norman Podhoretz from depicting it as a visitation specifically aimed at and deservedly incurred by Western homosexuals. While another Reagan-era celebrity, Pat Buchanan, orates about AIDS and moral bankruptcy, and Jerry Falwell offers the generic diagnosis that AIDS is God's judgment on a society that does not live by his rules. Sontag was accurate in her criticism of what was happening at that time, but it only scratches the surface of what was happening for people of faith and those of us in their communities. See, as faith leaders, we sometimes fulfill a complicated role in the lives we touch. A harsh and toxic comment from any person in a position of authority may cause undue pain. But when that person of authority can use the power of God as a weapon against the person who is struggling, how much more powerful their argument becomes, and how much more powerful the damage. In turn, I believe our capacity to do harm is more than matched by our capacity for healing and hope. If we are not people of a most uncommon hope, then let me ask you this: why are we pursuing lives of faith? It is important that we look back to those early missteps and cruel intentions and comments if we're going to make a change in the world around us. But the reality is that this is still going on in the world around us today. Musa Dubey, an activist and advocate for people living with AIDS in Botswana, reflected recently in the Global Bible Commentary, which I hope most of you have on your shelves, in a piece on Mark's healing stories. At the root of all these tough encounters is the social stigma that initially associated HIV and AIDS with sexual immorality, the fear of infection, and the ugly face of death. Her comments in 2000 very much match what our experience was in the early 80s, describing that people couldn't leave their homes once they found out they were living with the disease. Those insights, those reflections continue to be true again and again and again. So what is our responsibility to the hidden and invisible communities, to the oppressed and the marginalized around us? to our own experiences of marginalization? What is our responsibility? Well, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in his recent book, To Heal a Fractured World, The Ethics of Responsibility, says the following. From the Jewish perspective, we are here to make a difference, to mend the fractures of the world a day at a time, an act at a time, for as long as it takes, to make it a place of justice and compassion where the lonely are not alone, the poor not without help, where the cry of the vulnerable is heeded and those who are wronged are heard. Friends, we must ask ourselves and one another if we are taking on the isms around us that perpetuate one group or another always wearing a target on our backs and being silenced into oblivion. It wasn't just 1981 and 1982 when we thought it was okay to blame homosexuals for AIDS. It wasn't just 1981 and 1982 when we let people have too little information about what was happening in their bodies to get the treatment and care they really needed. AIDS is an opportunity, and here is the ethical challenge to you today. AIDS is an opportunity for people of faith, integrity, and compassion to say once and for all, and I want you listening really carefully, wake up if you fell asleep. Racism, classism, ageism, sexism, and heterosexism are not acceptable anymore. Racism, classism, ageism, sexism, and heterosexism, the time has come for us to put an end of these things. And AIDS is a great tool. AIDS opens the door for us to say that these issues of dividing human beings into categories of isolation and blame must stop. Bishop John Selders of the United Church of Christ, this just World AIDS Day that just passed, said the following. When churches start HIV/AIDS ministries as a community outreach service but perpetuate the down low by not embracing their same gender-loving brothers in their church pews, we are not serving our people. When white, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people are not equally incensed about the growing number of HIV/AIDS cases among poor, straight, African-American women, we are not serving our people. When HIV/AIDS clinics deny treatment to transgendered people like Maribel Reyes, who died needlessly in 2007, we are not serving our people. As well as when those of us in the United States refuse to see beyond our own backyard to how this epidemic is destroying entire countries, we are not saving or serving our people. These words by Selders are a really good start on building the uncommon hope required to heal and prevent the further spread of AIDS. When we get honest and begin to tell the reality of what is happening around the world, telling the truth and saying that we care and that we're willing first to talk, next to try and understand from our limited perspectives, and then to take action on what we discover. That is the place where we begin to build this uncommon hope. We don't need to live in a world of fractured lives and fractured faith anymore. People are in need of our stories of hope, our support, and in need of a safe haven. So labeling and limiting and subdividing aren't the job that we have ahead of us anymore. How will we stand with the people today who are living impacted, infected, and affected with AIDS? How will we share our stories of hope, strength, and survival in an ongoing age of AIDS? We can make a good start today by claiming our commitment to uncommon hope. Each of you in this room is a story that needs to be told, and I wish we had a week to tell them in here together. So I'll ask you to make a commitment to go from here and find a place to tell your story And if you think you do not have an AIDS story, I challenge you to find it. It is not possible to be alive in the world today and not have an AIDS story. If you don't have one, you just aren't asking yourself about it. AIDS has surely been a story with great loss in every chapter. But for every pen stroke of loss, there has been a conquest of uncommon hope. Will you stand with me and let me look into your eyes and leave you with this? You, my friends, my family, my community of faith, are the uncommon hope of the future. You are the story yet to be told. You are, in fact, the end of AIDS. Thank you.